and at the Interior Ministry. Shortly after 2:15 p.m. that Saturday, Sabour again entered the office where Loftus and Marchanti worked. They would have had to let him in because a coded lock secured the door. No Afghans were provided with the code, but they routinely were let in to access the snacks, bottled water, and medicine stored in the room. Sabour crossed the room, raised the Smith & Wesson 9mm pistol, and shot Marchanti in the head. He shot Darren Loftus in the back. Loftus fell face down. The killer leaned down and fired into the back of his victim's head. Sabour descended the stairs. At the building entrance, he told an Afghan colleague that the two American advisors had just shot each other. He walked past security guards and concrete barriers into the streets of downtown Kabul and disappeared. General John Allen arrived at the compound in a mine-resistant, ambush-protected transport vehicle, a hulk of plated metal designed to shield occupants from even the heaviest improvised bombs planted on roads by the Taliban. Allen stepped out in full battle gear and climbed to the office where Loftus and Marchanti still lay in pools of blood. He kneeled and prayed over the bodies. Allen ordered American advisors withdrawn from all Afghan ministries and pledged to develop new protocols that might keep American and European trainers safe. The murders of Darren Loftus and Robert Marchanti on one of the most heavily guarded compounds in Afghanistan, a short walk from the American-led war's command center, stunned ISAF's leadership. Despite Borden's warnings, a few dozen Afghan killers working behind American fences had managed to call the exit strategy of the world's most formidable military alliance into doubt. It would require another 18 months of secret intelligence investigations to identify the causes of the green-on-blue murder wave and to start to stymie its effects. "What do I tell his family today?" Senator Barbara Mikulski asked Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at a hearing on February 28, 2012, addressing the death of Robert Marchanti. "Was it worth it? Because they're angry. People in Maryland are angry." Mikulski added of the now decade-old Afghan war, "We went there with the best of intentions." Holly Loftus flew to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware to receive Darren's remains. She met Peggy Marchanti. An honor guard carried their husbands' caskets from the plane. On March 8th, at Hurlburt Field, another dress guard carried Loftus's casket across a tarmac to a funeral service with full honors. The Air Force awarded Darren Loftus a posthumous Bronze Star, his second. The base named a classroom at the schoolhouse in his memory. Holly's brother, the Reverend Dr. Brian Brewer, led the remembrances. He remembered a photo of Loftus taken during his first Afghan tour in 2009, when he had served on a provincial reconstruction team in Zabul province, in the Taliban's heartland. The picture showed Darren offering himself playfully to a group of Afghan children. Referring to the image, Brewer told the mourners, "It is representative of the ideal." Chapter 33. Homicide Division. Abdul Sabour's murder of Darren Loftus and Robert Marchanti moved the American War Command to restudy the threat. That two senior officers could be dispatched with pistol shots to the backs of their heads in a heavily guarded compound in the heart of Kabul suggested that no one or nowhere could be considered safe. The crime recalled nationalistic Afghan uprisings against British occupations of the 19th century. In the weeks that followed, the CIA circulated analysis in Washington, pointing out that the frequency of insider murders against American and European forces had surged to a rate 10 times greater than during the first decade of the war. The murders were on pace to constitute a quarter of all ISAF fatalities in 2012, an astounding percentage. Nothing like this had happened in Vietnam or during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. In fact, as far as the CIA's analysts could determine, Afghanistan's insider killing spree after 2011 had no precedent in the history of modern counterinsurgency. Following murders of its soldiers late in 2011, France announced a withdrawal of 2,000 combat soldiers from Afghanistan. Australia, Britain, Germany, and Spain all lost soldiers to killings by Afghan soldiers or police they worked alongside. The murder wave pulled at the foundations of every line of effort in NATO's campaign. The training of Afghan national security forces, the mentoring of Afghan police and technocrats in the ministries, and the resilience of political will in NATO capitals to fight on after a decade of effort. The Taliban, or whoever or whatever was the cause of the insider killing, had located exactly this political emotional milieu we are in, as a NATO diplomat in Kabul put it. All our capitals are tired. We lost the battle of public opinion 3 years ago, anyway. More vexing still, there was no consensus about why these insider killings had surged. Were the killers Taliban infiltrators who had slipped through the NDS vetting system designed to weed out enemy sympathizers from the Afghan National Army and police? Or were they non-Taliban who had become personally aggrieved over slights or insults from NATO soldiers and decided to take violent revenge? This was a murder mystery that had become the war's most important strategic puzzle. Murders of American and European soldiers by Afghan allies spiked up slightly in March 2012, and then ground along at an alarming rate of at least several per month into the summer. That year, Ramadan, the Islamic month of fasting and celebration, took place from July 20th to August 19th. Ramadan is a time of self-purification, of rituals of affiliation with faith. For individuals susceptible to the call to violent jihad against foreigners, the fasting and celebration in 2012 seemed to have a stimulating effect. On July 22nd, in Herat province, an Afghan policeman shot and killed three NATO trainers and wounded a fourth. The next day, in Faryab province, an Afghan colleague shot and wounded two NATO soldiers. Between August 3rd and the end of Ramadan, Afghan soldiers or policemen committed at least 9 more murders or attempted murders against NATO and American troops, killing 10 people, including 5 U.S. Marines, 2 of those special operations officers. During those final 2 weeks of Ramadan, Afghans attempted to kill Americans or Europeans they worked alongside about once every other day. Marine General John Allen's chief of intelligence, Mike Flynn's successor, was Robert Ashley, a 2-star Army general. He was a silver-haired, sober-faced man whose highly secured offices lay a short walk from Allen's command center at ISAF's headquarters in downtown Kabul. Ashley knew well that solving the insider murder problem had become critical. At August's rate of killing, the American plan for a slow, gradual drawdown from Afghanistan looked implausible. Ashley and Allen established a program of guardian angels, in which Western commanders appointed armed guards from their own ranks to watch over Afghan allies during joint activities. As the murders picked up during Ramadan, Allen authorized field commanders to appoint even more watchmen if they felt it was needed. But it seemed obvious that the more the Americans tightened their internal security protocols, the more Afghan allies were stripped of their weapons before meetings or endured armed American surveillance on patrol, the more likely it was that these allies would conclude that the Americans were their enemies. One night that August, Ashley's counterpart in the Afghan National Army, General Abdul Manan Farahi, the head of military intelligence, telephoned. It was unusual to hear from Farahi so late. Ashley stepped outside to take the call. "My friend, I just want to make sure, with Eid coming up," he said, referring to the celebration of Ramadan's end. "Just minimize the contact with the guys in the field, and take care." These were haunted times, Ashley told colleagues, as he relayed Farahi's message. Ashley decided He needed a fresh mind to analyze the crisis. He turned that autumn to one of the more unusual, naturally gifted characters in the American intelligence community. Mark Sageman, who was then in his late 50s, was a bald, white-bearded forensic psychiatrist and former CIA operations officer. He sometimes favored bow ties and spoke with a still noticeable French accent. He had been born in Poland, but raised as a refugee in France, where his parents had landed after surviving the Holocaust. Sageman matriculated at Harvard University at age 16, became a medical doctor, earned another doctoral degree in political sociology, served as a Navy flight surgeon, and then joined the CIA as a case officer. He worked in Pakistan during the 1980s, running frontline CIA contacts with Ahmad Shah Massoud's aides, among other Mujahideen commanders. Later, Sageman served as a psychiatrist on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania, where he studied murder, crime, and terrorism. Sageman was already conducting intelligence investigations for the Army, but not everyone in the command was a Sageman fan. Like some other very smart individuals, he could be dismissive of opinions he found wanting. He was an independent operator, not a team player, as one general in Washington warned Ashley. "I have nothing but team players, and we don't understand what's going on," Ashley replied. Sageman agreed to take on the Afghan murder project as a contractor. His title in Ashley's intelligence shop would be political officer. He flew to Bagram Airfield in mid-October. Sageman had never been in Afghanistan, at least not meaningfully. As a CIA case officer, he had accompanied Mujahideen rebels he armed and financed to the Afghanistan-Pakistan border and symbolically stepped a few yards onto Afghan soil to have his picture taken, but that was it. The CIA banned case officers from traveling with rebel clients inside Afghanistan for fear they would be captured and turned into tools for Soviet propaganda. As he touched down in Kabul, Sageman was ambivalent. He had a wife and son at home in the Washington suburbs. He had never bought into Obama's counterinsurgency strategy for Afghanistan. It was too ambitious, too disconnected from reality, he believed. But the opportunity to work as a kind of homicide detective was intriguing. And Sageman felt a quiet sense of purpose, to save as many American and European lives as he could by developing insights that might reduce the murder wave, to get as many soldiers and officers as possible safely home from a misbegotten war. Ashley had won approval for Sageman's assignment, in part because the psychiatrist had recently impressed the Army's leadership with his work on another classified, high-priority counterintelligence project. On November 5, 2009, at Fort Hood, Texas, Major Nidal Hassan, an Army psychiatrist, carried out a mass shooting against colleagues on the base, killing 13 people and wounding more than 30 before he was subdued. It turned out that Hassan had been in contact over the Internet with Anwar al-Awlaki, an American of Yemeni origin who had become a charismatic al-Qaeda preacher. After Fort Hood, the FBI and American intelligence agencies identified and reviewed American residents who had previously clicked on Awlaki's websites or exchanged email with him. The investigations revealed, among other things, that Awlaki's audience included about 100 active service members in the U.S. Army. This looked like a classic counterintelligence threat. What if, during the Cold War, the Internet had been around and the Army had discovered that 100 soldiers and officers were clicking through to the KGB? The Deputy Chief of Staff of the Army, General Richard Zahner, who oversaw the service's intelligence portfolio, called Sageman. "We have a problem here." Sageman joined the counterintelligence teams looking at the individuals who had clicked on Awlaki's materials. These case-by-case investigations took time, lasting into 2011. In the end, however, the review turned up only one individual, Nasser Jason Abdo, the son of a Jordanian father and an American mother, who seemed dangerous. In 2011, Abdo was arrested for conspiring to commit violence against fellow soldiers and was sentenced to life in prison. In the several dozen or so other cases Sageman and Army counterintelligence investigators examined, however, they found no evidence of dangerous jihadi radicalization. Sageman wrote up a classified analysis and briefed General Martin Dempsey, then the Chief of Army Staff, in his E-ring suite at the Pentagon. "You can't overreact, or you will break the Army by fostering a witch hunt for Muslim traitors," Sageman told the Army leadership. "You have 1.1 million soldiers in the Army. With turnover, we're talking about maybe 10 million soldiers over 10 years. And you have two cases, Hassan and Abdo. That's your base rate. Every 5 years, you're going to have some asshole." Dempsey and other Army commanders grasped the point. For all the anxiety generated publicly by members of Congress and cable TV demagogues, they did not face a strategic counterintelligence threat from Muslim American soldiers. It was a huge relief. At Bagram Airfield, Sageman hopped a helicopter to the Kabul airport, then rode in a convoy to ISAF headquarters. On board the helicopter, he met a young woman, a legal researcher who worked with the Judge Advocate General's office at Camp Eggers. "What do you have on the insider attacks?" Sageman asked her. "Not much," she said, "so far as she knew. But they exchanged cards and email addresses. It would prove to be a fortuitous encounter." At ISAF's headquarters, the compound of lawns and metal trailers, Sageman met Jeffrey Borden, the sociologist who had completed the landmark study of mistrust between American and Afghan soldiers early in 2011. They had lunch a few times and visited each other's offices twice. Sageman admired Borden, but found him a little closed and defensive, bruised by experience, at the least. As the problem of insider killings got worse, Borden had quietly returned to Afghanistan as an Army reservist to continue his research. The problem for him was that General Allen didn't appreciate his work any more than Petraeus had. Allen's mission was to promote comradeship and cooperation between ISAF and Afghan soldiers, shoulder to shoulder, as the slogan went, to allow NATO combat forces to leave the battlefield at the end of 2014. Allen believed that the alliance was sound fundamentally, and the Afghans he worked with from day to day did too. They reinforced Allen's belief that the fratricidal violence was best understood as a Taliban operation. In any event, in 2012, Borden found that ISAF had vastly undercounted the true number of fratricidal killings, by as much as 50%. The official count of a quarter of all NATO fatalities that year was bad enough. If Borden's estimate was right, ISAF was effectively at war with the Taliban and Karzai's armed forces simultaneously, an impossible position to sustain. But Allen's staff didn't believe Borden's numbers. They found the researcher stubborn and headstrong. He was a thorn in their sides. Borden's position in reply to such criticism was, "Yes, the truth hurts." Sageman and Borden now lived and worked in nearby trailers, by coincidence. They exchanged notes. As a social scientist, Sageman found Borden's work impressive and methodologically sound. Sageman was inclined to think that there was a direct causal link between the cultural misunderstandings Borden had documented on the front lines of the shoulder-to-shoulder program and the murders Sageman had come to investigate. It made sense intuitively. It seemed apparent to Sageman that international forces had overstayed their welcome. Fratricidal murder might represent only the most extreme outbursts in a chronically frayed atmosphere. The problem was Sageman had no data. Borden's interview records did not touch upon the particular killings upending NATO. They chronicled day-to-day perceptions among Afghan and American soldiers. Prior to 2012, NATO had not investigated or analyzed insider attacks systematically. Each victimized coalition government handled investigations according to its own procedures. The records were scattered. During 2012, the ISAF Joint Command, the war's day-to-day headquarters unit, which was located on the north side of Kabul's airport, adopted a new approach. The command created Joint Casualty Assessment Teams, JCATs as they were called, to investigate and report on insider attacks immediately after they took place. The teams flew to the site of a murder or attempted killing, more than half of the attacks took place in Kandahar and Helmand, where they would interview witnesses, examine the crime scene, and write up a report within 2 days. The Joint Command's intelligence unit reviewed these investigations. A Brigadier General, Paul Nakasone, oversaw the unit. He ran a department of 20 or so analysts, some from the Defense Intelligence Agency, others civilian. Not too many murder investigations can be resolved in just 2 days, but the JCATs were intelligence analysts, not homicide detectives working toward an arrest and conviction. The Joint Command's approach effectively prioritized speed over depth, in Sageman's view. He discovered that Great Britain had dispatched a brigadier of the Royal Dragoon Guards, Tim Hyams, to look at the insider threat across the NATO command. His title was Chief, Insider Threat Mitigation, and he oversaw a multinational cell of analysts and investigators. In late October, Sageman and Hyams traveled to the Joint Command headquarters to meet with the JCAT's murder investigation squads. But the analysts there told Sageman and Hyams that they had no data. This turned out to be untrue. They had been building a matrix of information about the killings they had investigated. Bureaucratic hoarding of intelligence was commonplace. Hyams did not have high-level clearances. The pair went away empty-handed, without even being told that the matrices on the cases existed. Sageman emailed the Army legal researcher he had met on the helicopter. He asked if she had copies of the 15-6 records of insider murder cases. These were highly detailed files created by the Army's Criminal Investigative Division staff, who looked into violent deaths where something other than straightforward combat might be involved. CID records often included extensive interviews with witnesses, reconstructions of crime scenes, and other rich evidence. They were subject to confidentiality and privacy rules, however. The researcher asked her boss, an Army lawyer, who wrote Sageman, "Do you have the names of the victims?" the lawyer asked. "That I have." "All right," she said, "but don't tell anybody about my cooperation." Ultimately, she sent Sageman records of 2 dozen insider murder cases that had involved Army personnel. Military CID investigators had conducted almost all of the reviews. An exception was the case of a female CIA base chief in Kandahar killed by an inside suicide bomber. CIA investigators had looked into that attack. It proved harder to persuade the Marines to turn over records. They had about 10 cases. And there were other cases involving Britain and continental European militaries. Of the files Sageman ultimately received, about 3/5 included full 15-6 files, each of which ran to hundreds of pages of interview notes and other documents. He traveled to Helmand and Regional Command headquarters elsewhere to talk to some of the investigators, as well as other officers who knew the cases. He also interviewed 10 confessed murderers being held in Afghan prisons. He began to build his own matrix of 40 factors in each shooting: where the Afghan shooter was from, what language he spoke, who the victims were, whether there was evidence of ideological motivation, how the attack had been executed, and so on. Some of the murders turned out to have little or nothing to do with either personal slights or the Taliban insurgency. In one case, a NATO unit that had been quietly paying off locals with a regular tanker of gasoline rotated out, and the incoming unit ceased the practice. The aggrieved smugglers shot the new soldiers. In 3 or 4 cases, Afghan soldiers who kept young Afghan boys as sex slaves, chai boys or tea boys, as the victims were euphemistically known, fell into apparent crises of conscience over their behavior and decided to purify themselves by joining the Taliban. To prove they were worthy, they shot up NATO soldiers on their way out. In Helmand, Sageman examined a case where local thugs involved in protection rackets for truckers decided to join the Taliban, but were told they had to first kill an American to prove their bona fides. This morass of corruption, sexual predation, and gang thugs becoming made men suggested Elmore Leonard's texture of debased human truths. But it was not obvious how violence of that character might be stopped. Other cases, however, provided evidence of direct Taliban military operations. The killing of the CIA's base chief that autumn was one such example. A brother of a local police chief in Kandahar defected to the Taliban and decided to carry out a suicide bombing. Telephone intercepts tracing all the way to Quetta documented the orders the bomber received. In essence, these orders were, "When your brother gets some VIPs visiting, go and blow yourself up." As he traveled, Sageman wrestled with the question of whether personal affronts or American arrogance provoked fratricidal murders. In late November, he investigated a case where there were rumors that the shooter had been outraged by a story that ISAF forces had held up a pregnant Afghan woman's car at a checkpoint, preventing her from getting to the hospital to deliver her baby. The JCAT report of the case chronicled this motivation. Supposedly, the shooter had learned of the woman's case and spontaneously attacked. Sageman picked through the 15-6 file, which included dozens of photographs of the attack taken from soldiers' helmet-mounted cameras. The photos, along with the interviews he conducted, showed that there was no civilian car involved, no pregnant woman. It was not clear where this story had even come from. The attacker had approached in a column of combined NATO and Afghan forces in the back of a pickup with a mounted machine gun. He had previously decided to join the Taliban and defected on the spot by opening fire at random military targets. Sageman stared at the photos and wondered if other reports about personal or cultural misunderstandings escalating into shootings might also be inaccurate. As the weeks passed, back at the ISAF compound, hunched over a restricted computer terminal, Sageman found that communication intercept evidence provided the greatest insights. Because of his previous Army counterintelligence work, Sageman had access to many compartments in the Joint Worldwide Intelligence Communications System, where the Army stored Taliban intercept records, among other sensitive information. Ashley assigned a DIA officer to help. Sageman and the officer extracted names, dates, and details from their 15-6 and other murder investigative files to use in searches to retrieve archived intercepts. Gradually, these transcripts led Sageman to change his thinking about the nature of the problem and to develop a new hypothesis. The hardest thing to let go of was the myth, as Sageman began to call it. This was the belief that cultural incompatibility between NATO and Afghan soldiers had grown so severe it occasionally turned murderous. Borden's valid field interviews had created a misleading impression, Sageman concluded. In fact, violence did not follow misunderstanding or resentment very often, Sageman found. In many cases, there was no or very little contact between the victim and the shooter before the murder. In these cases, the shooter behaved more like a mass killer who walked into a mall and fired on shoppers at random. There were clearly some acts of broad, well-publicized cultural or political provocation, the mistaken Quran burnings at Bagram in February 2012, and the following month, the mass murder of Afghan civilians carried out by U.S. Staff Sergeant Robert Bales near Kandahar. These incidents had provoked vengeance-seeking insider killings by Afghans. The murders of Loftus and Marshanti were an example. Of course, even their deaths did not arise from intimate misunderstanding between the shooter and his victims. To General Allen, these revenge killings after public events of desecration by Americans belonged to a different category from other insider violence. Altogether, Sageman concluded, there were 7 or 8 killings caused by cultural provocation, particularly the Quran burning, but these cases were far from a majority. The Taliban intercept records provided evidence that, in many more cases, Afghan soldiers and police changed their minds about which side of the war they wanted to be on. Then, from inside NATO bases, these side-switchers reached out to Taliban commanders by cell phone to volunteer their services. or through social networks, Taliban commanders opened phone conversations with government soldiers or police and recruited them to defect. The Taliban instructed the volunteers to kill NATO soldiers and then run away to join the Taliban. As the murders quickened, the visibility of insider killings created stimuli for new defectors. When contacted by volunteers, the Taliban encouraged them to murder NATO personnel because the killings made news and sapped Western morale. Encouraging a defector to kill on his way out the gate also resolved the Taliban's own counterintelligence risk. Because the shooter wrote his true intentions in blood and erased suspicion that he might be an NDS or CIA infiltrator. As Kabul nights turned freezing and Christmas neared, Saitman started to write up his findings and analysis. None of it was black and white, and plenty of mystery remained. What caused the insider Taliban volunteers to change their minds? This was harder to document because the phone intercepts did not typically reveal motivation, and many of the killers had been killed by return fire or had escaped. In any event, the number of Afghan defectors to the Taliban side was not particularly large or unexpected in such a war dividing families and tribes. It was, rather, the shocking death toll the shooters managed to exact as they switched sides that made them significant. There remained many cases, perhaps a quarter of the total, where the murderer's motivation was unknown or arose from some extraneous tangle like corruption rackets. As Sageman was writing, another of these cases turned up on his doorstep. On Christmas Eve 2012, Joseph Griffin, a 49-year-old American police trainer from Mansfield, Georgia, was shopping at a stall just outside police headquarters in downtown Kabul. He was looking for a belt buckle for his son, who was back in the States. A 33-year-old female Afghan police sergeant in uniform, who had trained as a sharpshooter, approached Griffin, pulled out a pistol, and shot him dead. The woman then tried to melt away among pedestrians. She was arrested before she could escape. Sageman hustled over from ISAF headquarters. He interviewed the shooter at the scene. She seemed to be faking a psychiatric condition, but didn't do it very well. Kabul police raided the woman's house and soon returned with garbage bags of her belongings and dumped them on a table. It turned out that she was an Iranian citizen who had married an Afghan refugee and then moved to Afghanistan with him. She was a Shia, the Islamic sect generally opposed to the Taliban, and she had recently been to the Iranian consulate about returning home. The Kabul police thought the murder was an Iranian operation, but Sageman doubted that. She had no apparent contact with anyone, Iranian or otherwise. He marked her down as another unknown. As Sageman completed his analysis, the subject of Ramadan jumped out of his numbers. The number of insider attacks had approximately tripled during Ramadan, then returned to its previous rate. This anomaly stood in contrast to the total number of security incidents in the Afghan war during the summer. The war's total measured violence had peaked in June and then fallen steadily into the autumn. If Ramadan was not a stimulant of combat, why was it a stimulant of insider murder? Sageman looked back at the less complete data for 2011 and saw a mini-peak of murder during Ramadan that year as well. One of the attackers Sageman interviewed in detention told him that Ramadan was a time when lots of informal religious discussions took place among Afghan soldiers and police working with NATO. The talk about religion and tradition might have tipped people predisposed to attack ISAF into actually doing so. Sageman also noticed that several of the murders linked to corruption or the sexual exploitation of children had taken place during Ramadan. "The holy month," he wrote, "is a time when people look for redemption, especially people who might have a guilty conscience." In January, Sageman completed a draft of The Insider Threat in Afghanistan in 2012. The unclassified version ran to 30 pages with 100 footnotes. Its main argument sought to debunk the myth of personal social insensitivity as a factor in insider murders. His review of all the 2012 cases failed to detect a single case where direct, personal, social misunderstandings escalated into confrontation ending in a lethal firefight. More general perceived cultural insults did stimulate violence in about 10% of cases, according to Sageman's analysis. But these perceived insults fell on fertile ground because a majority of the murderers studied had connected with the Taliban before they decided to kill, either because they were recruited while on the inside or because they volunteered. Sageman reported that 56% of the inside attackers had solid links to the insurgency, another 9% had probable links, and another 10% had possible links. These conclusions came substantially from the telephone intercept records he and his DIA colleague had examined. Altogether, then, 75% of the attacks involved shooters who had at least possible prior links to the Taliban. They were not infiltrators, however. They were side-switchers. Their motivation was group identification, as Muslims or Afghans, where the terms of membership required violent action against the enemy. In that sense, Sageman's hypothesis was even darker than Borden's. In theory, cultural misunderstanding might be overcome through training. The broad, fertile belief that American soldiers were occupiers could be addressed only by their departure. Sageman's findings had one major implication for NATO operations. Its forces needed a much more attentive counterintelligence program to monitor the communications of Allied Afghan soldiers and police to detect defectors before they acted. If some of the phone conversations Sageman reviewed had been monitored when they took place, killings would have been prevented. The challenge is to detect people who defect to the insurgency after they join government forces. By Sageman's count, 4 out of 5 shooters joined the Taliban after they had been initially vetted for the Afghan army or police. Only 1 out of 5 was a true sleeper or infiltrator. Many perpetrators were recruited in place by their peers or superiors, either for ideological or political reasons, especially during Ramadan, or by corrupt commanders trying to reach a compromise with the insurgency. Sageman's analysis also showed that there was a strong statistical likelihood that when one insider murder took place, another would follow within 2 days. This copycat pattern in the numbers also had operational implications. After an attack, NATO should raise its alert levels for several days. After that, statistically at least, the threat subsided. The report's bar graphs again created a reassuring sense of clarity, but the case studies Sageman mustered were dismal and evocative of the felony docket in a mafia stronghold. A police checkpoint commander and his deputy had extensive connections to both local insurgents and drug traffickers. The commander also allegedly sexually abused young adolescents who were forced to serve him. He took an interest in a young, handsome police recruit of low intelligence. The commander and his deputy encouraged the young recruit to shoot at ISAF forces accompanying a female USAID civilian inspecting a local school. Prior to the attack, the deputy gave the eventual shooter some opium. A corrupt Army combat outpost commander, who extorted money from local villagers and sexually abused young recruits and had extensive connections to insurgents, encouraged a young soldier to carry out an attack on ISAF, who were transferring the outpost over to the Afghans. The commander claimed that the withdrawing forces would take all the weapons, tanks, and vehicles with them. One of his subordinates carried out the attack, and the commander organized the escape with the help of insurgents. All militaries, including the U.S. Army, had to manage criminals in their ranks and the threat of traitors. The practical thing to do was to catch them before they did too much damage. In many of the cases Sageman reviewed, people within the Afghan National Security Forces knew about the plans to carry out an insider attack in advance. Sometimes the plot was reported up the Afghan chain of command, but nothing was done. And nobody told American or European commanders about what was going on. That reflected deeper problems in the Afghan system. The failure of leadership is often compounded by widespread corruption by ANSF unit leaders using their position to extort money from local citizens, commercial traffic crossing their area of responsibility, and drug trafficking, Sageman wrote. Sageman briefed Allen, who embraced the findings, despite the discouraging elements. The analysis affirmed Allen's core belief. American and Afghan government forces were allies who had and would share sacrifice to defeat the Taliban. The problem was not cultural incompatibility. The problem was the insurgency. In truth, Sageman's evidence made clear, it was both. Allen could not do much about Sageman's belief that the presence of international troops in such large and visible numbers was itself dangerously provocative. Sageman had at least identified a counterintelligence task, identifying Taliban defectors after they were vetted at enlistment but before they struck. That offered a path to improvement as the American withdrawal went on. And he had provided Allen with a framework for talking to Afghan and American troops about the murder wave. The general could use Sageman's evidence to move from "let's hang together" speeches to a rallying cry, "we have a determined enemy." Sageman's report overturned the analysis earlier circulated by the ISAF Joint Command intelligence analysts. They had found a much lower percentage of links to the Taliban than Sageman did, and therefore had emphasized the theme of cultural friction. In intelligence bureaucracies, it is common to attack the findings of rival units. Tribalism is a factor, but the disputes can also reflect a healthy marketplace of ideas. The lead Joint Command analyst on the murder wave was a civilian with a bachelor's degree. Her team told Ashley that Sageman was wrong, that he had misclassified his cases, misread the evidence, and ended up with a distorted picture of high Taliban involvement in the killings. According to the Joint Command matrix of cases, only 18% of shootings showed links to the insurgency. She and her analysts sent Ashley a long, line-by-line critique of Sageman's report. Ashley called Sageman in. "We have to resolve this," he said. Sageman explained that his differing conclusions were grounded in intercepts that Joint Command analysts had probably not examined. Ashley appointed what was, in effect, a 3-judge appellate panel. 3 DIA analysts, including the one who had worked with Sageman. They looked at every case. To support his brief, Sageman pulled documents from 6 different systems that he had used to accumulate his evidence. In the end, after extensive reviews and debate, the appellate panel downgraded one of Sageman's findings of definite links to the Taliban to probable, but it upgraded another from probable to definite. He felt vindicated. That winter, Sageman returned to Washington. From there, he helped ISAF headquarters, Lessons Learned Team, rewrite standard operating procedures to account for the category of internal defectors he had identified, to monitor their communications and improve vetting. Some of his Pentagon colleagues wanted to send portable lie detectors to Afghanistan. Even though American courts regarded them as unreliable, polygraphs were a routine tool of counterintelligence vetting at the CIA and other American intelligence agencies. Sageman and the other analysts involved didn't think they would work in the environment he had seen in Helmand and Kandahar. The only thing Afghan police and army commanders would use them for would be to beat the other guy, meaning the detainee, with the machine. Ashley thought the polygraph machines, adapted for use in the Pashto language, were effective, as one part of an array of new measures. These included the deployment of more investigators to support the screening system, Allen's Guardian Angel programs, and stepped-up efforts to persuade Afghan leaders that they had to take greater responsibility. The new standard operating procedures did not end the insider murder wave. The number of attacks declined in 2013 and 2014, but so did the number and activity of NATO troops. During Allen's tour, his command closed about 500 out of about 835 NATO bases and outposts in Afghanistan. European governments reduced or ended their military commitments to the Afghan war, but they did not abandon support for the Karzai government's struggle with the Taliban. Allen believed the murder rate fell because of the measures taken during and after Sageman's investigations, not because of the reduction in troop numbers. Allen understood Sageman's point about the provocative potential of the international troop presence. He thought it could be overcome, but Karzai's public criticism made it harder. Karzai's rhetoric played into the Taliban's narrative. Once, Allen confronted Karzai in his office at the ARG. "Look at the numbers that are in school today," he said. "Look at the numbers of Taliban we removed that were victimizing your population." Karzai cited the number of tribal leaders being assassinated in Kandahar and implied that the Americans had a hand in the violence, so as to sow chaos, so as to have a reason to stay in Afghanistan. Allen came out of his seat. "We aren't staying. We are going home. If you're implying that we are committing these assassinations, you need to tell me." Karzai backed off. This had become his familiar demeanor. He shared freely his belief that the United States had a hidden agenda in Afghanistan, otherwise it would do something about Pakistan and the ISI. But he never went so far as to sever relations with American counterparts altogether. Later, when Allen's mother died, Karzai called him to offer personal condolences. Sageman reflected on what he had learned. He had spent the last several years studying counterintelligence problems in several settings, the U.S. Army, the Afghan Army, and police. The Army also commissioned him to study military traitors during the Cold War period to determine what insights might be gained. Whether the context was Soviet-inspired communism, or the Taliban, or the Islamic State, Sageman concluded, an individual's act of crossing over to the other side was often about identification, not ideology. It was about feeling a part of someone else's imagined community, in the anthropologist Benedict Anderson's resonant phrase. Such a change of identification might arise from discussions with friends or co-workers. It might arise from provocations like Quran burnings or images of civilian casualties on the battlefield. Sageman now believed that this had implications for American counterterrorism policy. If the United States escalates a conflict violently and visibly, that action would, as a side effect, contribute to more terrorism. For the Army Sageman served, it would not be a satisfying or popular insight, but it was where the evidence led him. Chapter 34. Self-inflicted wounds. Early in 2012, Doug Loot moved from his cramped office in the West Wing of the White House to a suite on the third floor of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building next door. His walls displayed photos of the smoking rubble in New York after the September 11th attacks, and of President Obama on a tarmac in Afghanistan talking to American soldiers and to Karzai. Another showed Loot briefing the president. Topographical and demographic maps of Afghanistan and Pakistan were mounted nearby. On the floor was one of those Afghan rugs woven for foreigners, depicting an AK-47 and a helicopter gunship. Jeff Eggers, the former Navy SEAL, served as Loot's deputy. The seven other directors or professional staff included Jeff Hayes, the DIA analyst who had negotiated with Tayyip Aga. Loot had now been the principal National Security Council specialist on Afghanistan and Pakistan for 5 years, across two administrations, an unusually long run in such a grinding wartime role. He had started as an operations man, a West Point credentialed general who could connect White House policy with Pentagon systems. During the first years of the Obama administration, he had evolved into a skeptical but influential coordinator, the guy who seemed to be in every meeting, taking notes, and who could run the back channels at the White House to Tom Donilon or Dennis McDonough, who were then Obama's most trusted foreign policy advisors. White paper after white paper, interagency review after interagency review, trip after trip to Afghanistan and Pakistan, Loot mastered the file. He tried to keep his thinking fresh, by consulting outsiders. He maintained his somewhat unlikely friendship with Barney Rubin and consulted the State Department advisor regularly. Lute had become a passionate believer in the necessity of pursuing a peace deal with the Taliban. According to the CIA's classified district assessments, despite the American-led combat escalation after 2009, the territory assessed to be under Taliban control had expanded by about 1%. The two sides had fought to a draw. If the Taliban could not be defeated militarily, and if the movement was to be prevented from returning to power, the only plausible alternative was some kind of political settlement. After Karzai's demands scuttled the talks with Tayyip Aga, the Qataris initiated a new attempt to get direct talks between the Taliban and the United States back on track. Obama sent word down. He, too, wanted another major effort to get the negotiations restarted. Kayani had closed American ground supply routes through Pakistan to Afghanistan in retaliation for the deaths of Pakistani soldiers in the border incident at Salalah late in 2011. The closure of Pakistani routes had forced Central Command and General John Allen to import materials from the north of Afghanistan and by air, at an expense to taxpayers of $100 million more per month compared with the Pakistani option. The impasse had become a politicized, highly public matter of honor, with the Pakistanis demanding an American apology and the Obama administration still seething over the discovery of Osama bin Laden at Abbottabad, among other offenses, unwilling to bend. Lute decided to go back to work on the relationship with Kayani. The first task was to reopen the supply routes. Peter Lavoy, the Pakistan specialist now in charge of Asia-Pacific policy at the Pentagon, negotiated with Sheri Rahman, the new Pakistani ambassador to Washington, and Hina Rabbani Khar, the foreign minister. The Pentagon did have financial leverage. It had suspended the coalition support funds to the Pakistan Army, running into hundreds of millions of dollars annually. There was also $500 million or so in defense equipment that the Pakistanis wanted that had been placed on hold. By late spring, Lavoy and his counterparts had sorted out a deal. Hillary Clinton issued a careful statement that acknowledged mistakes on both sides, which the Pakistanis accepted as the apology they had required. Lute arranged to visit Kayani at Army House in Rawalpindi. He brought Lavoy and, initially, Mark Grossman. After Grossman left office at the end of 2012, James Dobbins, who had helped to negotiate the original Bonn Accord, replaced him as the State Department's special envoy. Lute inaugurated what would become, over the ensuing months, half a dozen long, private, discursive conversations with Kayani at Army House. The purpose was to try to find a way to structure a peace deal that would end the war in Afghanistan, or at least greatly reduce its violence. If the Afghan Taliban continued to sow chaos across the border, this would inevitably strengthen the Pakistani Taliban, Kayani's principal domestic insurgent threat. Gradually, in private, they developed a shared commitment to drawing Tayyip Aga and the Taliban political leadership back into talks. They met in the wood-paneled reception room of the bungalow, the room where Kayani's stewards gave prominent display to ancient Chinese vases and other gifts from Beijing. Kayani chain-smoked from his stemmed holder. After each session, the Americans stumbled back to their quarters, typically in the early hours of the morning, their eyes watering and their clothes in need of fumigation. Lute habitually took notes in a government-issued green cloth-bound notebook, and he would write little tick marks every time Kayani lit up. After all the recent history, after Kayani 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0, after Raymond Davis and bin Laden, after the secret negotiations with Tayyip Aga, where the Americans had largely locked Kayani and Pasha out of the channel, Lute's idea now was to come clean. Lute believed that no political agreement with the Taliban, if one could be achieved at all, would be sustainable without Pakistan's participation, even though Tayyip Aga had insisted that the Taliban wanted to negotiate independently with the United States, free from ISI pressure. For the first time, the Americans told Kayani the whole story about their talks with Tayyip Aga. They narrated the history of the meetings and the confidence-building measures. How Tayyip Aga had delivered a proof-of-life video of Bo Bergdahl. How he had been able to place certain agreed-upon statements in Taliban media. They told Kayani how far they had gotten in negotiating for prisoner exchanges that would lead to the opening of a Taliban political office in Qatar. And they related the embarrassing story of how Hamid Karzai had blown up that deal. It was always hard to tell exactly what Kayani knew and didn't know, but he seemed surprised by how far the Americans had gone with Tayyip Aga, how close they were to a meaningful initial agreement, one that would legitimize the Taliban on the international stage. This had been a historical goal of ISI. Kayani's take in private on Tayyip Aga's credibility and about the personalities within the Taliban leadership was similar to American analysis. About Karzai, the general was dismissive. The Americans should be able to force Karzai to do what they needed. About the Taliban, the ISI's client, Kayani sang a different tune. The ISI had contact but not control, and there was no way Kayani could deliver the Taliban to some sort of grand peace bargain. They also spoke candidly about the military stalemate in Afghanistan. In the first meetings, Kayani had some I-told-you-so to get out of his system. He had, in fact, long expressed doubt about the American faith in military success against the Taliban in such a short time, and also about Washington's hurried, expensive project to enlarge, train, and equip Afghan national security forces. For their part, Lute and Lavoie gradually allowed themselves to express personal views about the Afghan war, opinions that departed from the Obama administration's public line. Essentially, they told Kayani, look, Washington understands. The U.S. military does not yet understand, but Washington understands that we aren't going to win in Afghanistan. There is no amount of military effort there that is going to look like victory, and we know the problems and the limits we have with the Afghan government. The point was, didn't the United States and Pakistan now have a common interest in preventing the Taliban from returning to power via armed revolution? Wouldn't that outcome be even worse for Pakistan than for the United States? A restored Islamic Emirate in Kabul would fire up the Pakistani Taliban and provide them with a deep base for operations against Kayani's military. Kayani said he agreed. In fact, his army's experiences in the tribal areas since 2008 had led him, by 2012, to an outlook similar to Lute's. Enough with clear, hold, build, transfer. He had lost faith in the effectiveness of military clearing operations. And after the annus horribilis of 2011, it was a relief to be freed from the grand ambitions of Plan Pakistan. If this was a transactional relationship, a matter of hard-headed interests, not a deep strategic partnership, then it was possible to let go of some of the emotions of betrayal and disappointment. Kayani's idea was to approach the problem of reducing violence in Afghanistan subtly, privately, through local managed ceasefires and political experiments in different Afghan provinces. But when Lute and Lavoie pressed Kayani for specifics, they felt he often drifted off into abstraction. The Americans sought to draw the discussions toward a negotiating plan, to revive the suspended talks with Tayyip Aga, to achieve the goals already identified. A prisoner exchange, a Taliban political office in Qatar, and the advancement of comprehensive talks that would include Karzai's government and its democratic opposition. In April, Ryan Crocker and Marine General John Allen concluded months of negotiations with Karzai over a new strategic partnership agreement between the United States and Afghanistan, one designed to publicly ratify American commitment to Afghanistan's future security. Obama agreed to fly to Kabul to sign the document publicly with Karzai, a symbolic and visible gesture of public diplomacy. Karzai wanted a grand ceremony where elders from across the country would attend. Crocker, too, thought a grand event would send a strong signal. Yet the Secret Service, taking note of the suicide bomber who killed Rabbani with explosives hidden in a turban, insisted that anyone in Obama's presence would have to remove his